past few weeks, we have been exploring the secret life of a CEO. We began by looking at what CEOs actually do, whether they're worth all that money, and how someone becomes a CEO. We had a long conversation with Indra Nooyi, the CEO of PepsiCo, and then looked into crisis management. Last week, we looked at why there are so few female CEOs. And today, we reach the end of the road, letting go of the corner office.
The reason I left was not that I was tired.
We'll look into how transparent companies are about making a CEO change.
Who is that person? Shouldn't we all know who that is?
And what do ex-CEOs do with all that time and money?
I own a basketball team.
I bought the Magna Carta.
That's coming up right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Perhaps the biggest challenge for any CEO is the transition, whether it's sudden and involuntary or a well-executed succession plan.
The day you become CEO, you have to think about grooming a successor.
Indra Nooyi has been CEO of PepsiCo since 2006.
How do you, take people and give them bigger assignments?
It wasn't always thus. The process of grooming and choosing a successor wasn't always so methodical.
When I started doing this work in the 1970s, virtually every CEO would have some version of, that's taken care of. That's right here. And they'd open up a drawer and pull out an envelope with the names in here.
That's Jeff Sonnenfeld from the Yale School of Management. He has been studying leadership for decades.
Who is that person? Shouldn't we all know who that is? Certainly we on the board should know. What's the training that person has? What's their preparation? What are the alternatives? Have we benchmarked some people against the outside? That was the way things were in the 70s.
What about the 80s?
In the 1980s, people were being stacked, whether or not it was through mergers or whatever. Commitments were being made. Okay, this person will be the next CEO. We were coming out with some very recipe-like HR practices that somebody is ready now and ready in 5 years and whatever.
And who was responsible for writing these successor recipes?
There's often a czar of some sort of executive development that would report directly to the CEO that had tremendous kingmaker or queen-making power. You were worried about that person. They were legendary. They could derail people's careers. There's a lot of personal prejudice and ethnic and gender, racial bias often built into those roles. So that was a real problem in the 80s.
Okay. Glad we're out of the 80s. What about the 90s?
Then, we started to see the supremacy of certain functions that with all the deal-making frenzy that somehow finance had this primacy and CFOs had raced past COOs.
One firm that participated in that deal-making frenzy was General Electric under Jack Welch. He stepped down in 2001, having run GE for 20 years. You'd been there a while and you were getting on in years, but I'm guessing if you'd really wanted to, you could have powered through some more years. How do you know as a CEO that it's time to go?
The reason I left was not that I was tired. The problem was you have expectations in a bureaucracy. And the expectations of these talented, wonderful people. I didn't do it because I was tired or bored. I loved it. I did it because it was the right thing to do for the rest of the people. And I would have expected it when I was there. That there's a certain rhythm. And 65 was the rhythm in GE.
Meaning Welch was going to be 65 years old, and it was time for someone else to have their turn at the top. He and the GE board meticulously plotted his succession. Their candidate list began with 24 names. Over the next 4 years, Fortune magazine reported, Welch tried to fill the gaps in all the candidates' resumes and test their ability to grow. Finally, the 24 were narrowed down to 3. After another round of auditions, Welch and the board made their decision.
I told the two guys that weren't going to get it, I told all 3 6 months before, all three of you are going to have new jobs. One of you is going to be running GE, and two of you are going to be CEOs elsewhere.
The two who didn't get the job indeed wound up as CEOs elsewhere. Jim McNerney at 3M and later at Boeing, and Robert Nardelli at Home Depot and after that at Chrysler. The man who did get the GE job? Jeff Immelt, who would go on to run GE until 2017. His record was, at best, mixed. The firm's value fell a great deal. Some blamed Immelt, some blamed economic forces, and some blamed Welch for having built a conglomerate with so many moving parts that it was unsustainable. Welch famously pushed GE well beyond its manufacturing and technology roots into businesses like insurance and financial services, businesses that GE has since sold off. I'm just curious, did you regret that you had to take on so much of financial services to drive profit? You didn't?
No, I thought we had tons of leverage there. We had a great balance sheet. We had a talent in financial services. We had our own homegrown financial management program where we could put people. We built great businesses, and I would still be in it if I was running it.
Oh, really? That's interesting. So you wouldn't have divested
all... Wells Fargo is doing beautifully with the assets they bought.
Yeah, well, it helps when you're making up a fake million accounts here and there, right?
Well, that's not the businesses they bought.
So you're saying that you would not have divested the financial services stuff if you were still...
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I might not have gotten in the trouble that they got in by exploding in real estate. But that's second guessing. You can't second guess a CEO. That happened 8 years after I left. That's the normal tenure for two CEOs. To talk about what I would have done or what somebody else would have done when I was there is unfair.
In 1999, not long before you retired from GE, you said that your ultimate success would be determined by how well your successor grows the company over the next 20 years.
Right.
When you said that, GE's market cap was up north of $450 billion. Now, it's almost 20 years later, it's just north of $200 billion. So, talk to me about that. I know that you...
I don't talk about that.
You don't? Why not? I mean, it's public record. I mean,
well,
we know that...
You can comment on it any way where you want, but I'm not... I haven't commented on my successor once in the 20 years. And I don't intend to comment now. You can judge me any way you want on whether I picked the right guy or not. You gave numbers, and one from those numbers would question how well I did. But I'm not commenting. And if you want to give me a black mark, give me a black mark. I did the best I could. I picked the guy.
I'm curious whether you carry over this tradition from the U.S. presidential tradition, where it's a kind of standard for the former president to stay out of things, or did you come up with this on your own?
My predecessor came up with it. He never commented on me, and I radically changed everything he did. And he sat quietly and was a friend.
The transition from Jack Welch to Jeff Immelt was considered so sensible, so thorough, that business schools taught it as a perfect example of how to search for and install a successor. Oh well. It doesn't mean it wasn't sensible and thorough, or that Immelt was the wrong man. It just means that business is hard. And most big firms throughout history do lose their mojo. The CEO who recently replaced Immelt, John Flannery, he's not having a very good time either. When we spoke with Welch, GE's market cap was just above $200 billion. It's since fallen by more than $70 billion. Now, if you think that kind of CEO transition is hard, how about one where the CEO started the company?
Generally, the companies that are going to make it are the companies that have a CEO founder who has driven the company for the first couple years.
That's David Rubenstein, co-founder and longtime CEO of the Carlyle Group, one of the biggest private equity firms in the world. He's worked with and seen every kind of CEO transition imaginable, in medium-sized firms looking to get bigger, in big firms looking to reboot, and what he's talking about here in startups that outgrow their CEO founders.
And then you'd bring in a CEO who's better at managing a more mature company than somebody who's getting it off the ground.
What about when the startup CEO wants to stay and plainly isn't the right person for the job? How do you handle that?
It can be a very complicated conversation. Typically, outside investors may have the majority voting stake or the majority of the board by years three or four, and they might have the ability to vote out the CEO, but it's not pleasant. So sometimes you give the CEO different responsibilities.
I've delegated pretty well all the CEO roles.
And that is Richard Branson of the Virgin Group, a conglomerate with many companies in many industries. Branson started Virgin when he was a teenager. Now he's 67.
And I actually believe that people should delegate early on in their businesses so they can start thinking about the bigger picture. And we accept that, you know, some things they'll do differently than us, some things they'll do better than us.
It strikes me that even the most public-facing of those CEOs is much less public-facing than you. In many ways, the Virgin brand is really Richard Branson. That, at least, is my assessment. I'd love to hear your assessment and how you see yourself as a representative of your firm.
You know, if you go back to when I was 15, 16, I didn't have any money, and I was starting a company without financial resources. So, you know, I would do anything I could to get Virgin on the map, even if it meant, you know, jumping in boats or balloons and trying to break world records, etc. I think that worked. I think the Virgin brand is here to stay, and hopefully will outlast me, and that was the original plan.
You know, that's what I wanted to ask you next. I'm glad you brought it up. What would Virgin look like beyond Richard Branson? And I'm curious if you think about succession.
Well, I'd be irresponsible not to. First of all, we all the companies are run by wonderful people. We have a chairman and chief executive who run the group on a day-to-day basis, you know, but I'm still enjoying myself. So, you know, for the next 10 or 20 years, I'm still going to be very much involved, I hope.
He is kind of elusive.
Jeff Sonnenfeld again.
He's a moving target. He, has an inspirational quality. No matter what the crisis is or the success is, it's very Richard-centric. You can't list, you know, with Jack Welch, you can list, like them or not, you can list 20, 25, 30 very high profile and for the most part, very successful progeny. Some of them loved him, some of them didn't, but his very strong record of leadership creation and identification with Branson. I don't know. Can people name one, two, three? I mean, that is a sign of grandiosity that isn't something which is generally used as a yardstick outside of the world of entertainment.
So Jeff Sonnenfeld, as a CEO observer, isn't so impressed with how Richard Branson has managed the next generation of leader. There's another founding CEO of a much younger company that Sonnenfeld also disapproved of.
I thought he showed an incredible audacity to not learn and listen as a leader.
He's talking about Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook.
He was obviously technologically brilliant, but self-absorbed, if not even disdainful, of the people who were giving him the money to make him so wealthy, sending out videos of himself with the hoodie on, not going out and meeting on the road shows with investors.
At least that's what Sonnenfeld used to think.
Oh my gosh, has he changed? He's a reminder that, yeah, adults can learn and grow. He had a great board, great mentors, and also he's just been a great learner. He has been remarkably different now as a leader than he was when he first became CEO.
Facebook has been the subject of intense scrutiny for years now. That's what happens when you've gone from a college dorm startup to a social network with some 2 billion global users. Zuckerberg, despite rumors of his political ambitions, seems ready to stay at Facebook for a while at least. After all, he's only 33. So he's got time before he starts thinking about letting go. As Sonnenfeld says, he's shown remarkable growth. Here's what Zuckerberg told us recently about managing employees.
The real art, I think, is not not when you know that you have someone who's a superstar who's going to make great decisions, but deciding to let people do things that you disagree with because on principle, and you know it's just going to free up more creativity and people will feel like there's more potential to try different things in the future that may be better if you let them go do those things, even if you disagree with them.
Still, the time will come eventually to let go. At some point, Zuckerberg may start asking his elders how they did it, what worked, what didn't work, and what it feels like.
Well, first of all, I know that I don't know how anything's going to go until I actually experience it.
Coming up after the break, we talk to a founder who did step aside, and we look at the afterlife of a CEO. That's right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
Well, first of all, I know that I don't know how anything's going to go until I actually experience it.
That's Ray Dalio, the founder of Bridgewater Associates, the world's largest hedge fund.
I have a saying, if you haven't done it three times successfully before, you probably don't know how to do it.
Dalio founded Bridgewater in the 1970s. It is not a typical company. Built in Dalio's image, it became famous for practicing what he called radical honesty and radical transparency. It wasn't for everybody.
The senior partner said that you're making people uncomfortable, you're demoralizing them with your straightforwardness.
But it worked. Today, the firm manages roughly $160 billion.
And so when I undertook the process of transitioning, I said, well, I think that this is going to go quick, maybe 2 or 3 years, but I'm not actually sure that of how it would go.
I'd love you to talk for just a second, Ray, about when you stepped down as CEO a few years ago and installed a new CEO, but then had to step back in as temporary co-CEO. I'm just curious, what happened? What'd you miss?
So I realized like the transition from a founder-owned company to an independent company is, you know, classically very challenging. And so how do you approach that? How do you strike that balance? I wanted to be totally a mentor, being there for other people and letting them do it the way that they wanted to do it. And then I found myself in the surprising position of having them struggle with that, unacceptably struggle with that.
And this was a guy who you'd hired as a kid, essentially, and had been around forever, and I gather we're very close with, yes?
Yeah, you know, for like 20 years. And, you know, I love the guy. I mean, literally wonderful, deep relationship, brilliant man. And I think it was largely my fault, too. I think I gave him too much. You know, when the business grew up, there were two things. I had to get my head into all the investment and economic stuff that I do, and then also run a business simultaneously. And any one of those things is too much for any human being, me included. And then to take that and then sort of to give it to this person, you know, I made the mistake, essentially, of giving too much.
The man in question here is named Greg Jensen. He's still at Bridgewater, but as co-CIO now, chief investment officer.
So we had that evolution, but we didn't anticipate it.
Jensen and Bridgewater were in the news again recently. The Wall Street Journal reported that Bridgewater had paid a settlement of more than $1 million to a former employee Jensen had an affair with, apparently while he was running the firm. He was also accused of sexually harassing at least one other female employee. Jensen called the report, quote, inaccurate and salacious, and Dalio defended him as a man of high character. Whether Jensen's behavior contributed to his demotion is unknown, but when he was demoted, Ray Dalio stepped back in to co-run the firm, along with a tech executive recruited from outside Bridgewater. That guy lasted less than a year. Finally, in April of 2017, Dalio put Bridgewater in the hands of two longtime insiders, and he remained, along with Greg Jensen, co-CIO. So what happened that Dalio was finally ready to step down again?
We learned a structure. And I learned a whole bunch of things that I never understood before, like about governance.
That's the thing about being CEO of a firm you started. It's your firm. It's got your shape and idiosyncrasies. Part of the reason people start their own companies in the first place is to escape the cookie-cutter mentality. But that can leave you, as it left Dalio, with a lot of blanks to fill in later, during a CEO transition that lasted a lot longer than he had anticipated.
How do you do the right checks and balances? Should you have a board? Should you not have a board? What are the processes and all of that? So it became a learning process that evolved over 7 years.
Another founding CEO who recently stepped down, but not aside completely, is David Rubenstein. His new title is co-executive chairman.
I have a theory that if you retire, you could go downhill quickly. And I have a theory that if you relax too much, your immune system relaxes. Germs come in and they see a relaxing immune system. They attack. And all of a sudden, you're in trouble. So I don't want to relax too much because I'm afraid that bad things will happen.
Jack Welch is another former CEO who's kept very, very busy.
I started my own school.
It's called the Jack Welch Management Institute, which is what exactly?
An MBA program online, fully accredited for working adults.
And there's also this.
I've given thousands of speeches around the world. I've taught at MIT for 6 years.
We don't have good data on this, but it would seem that the kind of person who's capable of becoming a CEO is often, like Jack Welch and David Rubenstein, not the kind of person who wants to just chill out. Plus which, golf is not Rubenstein's thing.
I concluded that with respect to golf, that it was too frustrating and too humiliating because I have the view that if I have a business meeting with somebody and they think that I'm competent and intelligent, if I were to go on the golf course, I would destroy the illusion of competence and intelligence.
I really love golf. My first year I retired, I played 100 rounds.
That's Steve Ballmer, who ran Microsoft from 2000 to 2014. So plainly, he's in the pro golf camp. Ballmer's departure from Microsoft was a bit messy, with some hurt feelings. I'm curious, going forward, how much you care, or I guess, how do you care about Microsoft's future success?
Well, when I ran Microsoft, I was always consistent in saying the number one measure of whether I did a good job or not would be what Microsoft would look like 10 or 15 years after I left. And so I can't do anything at this stage. You know, I'm just an outside independent guy. On the other hand, of course, I'm rooting for the company for three reasons. I'm a shareholder because it is the mark of whether I did a good job or not. And part of that is the succession plan. And oh, by the way, I got a lot of friends who work over there and I think the world of.
And don't be fooled by all that golf Ballmer plays. He's got a lot of other stuff going on.
Hoopers, hoopers, hoopers. I own a basketball team.
The Los Angeles Clippers is Ballmer's team. He's also involved in a lot of philanthropies, including a website called USA Facts, which synthesizes 30 years' worth of data from federal, state, and local governments. It's sort of a fiscal colonoscopy of the American government.
If I'm a citizen, I don't want to know just where the government got its money from whom and where it spent it. But is it working at all, or at least what activity is it generating? Do we like the kind of outcomes we're getting?
That's the thing about the afterlife of the CEO. You've got money, you've got connections, you've still got name recognition, if not as much actual leverage. But you've also got freedom of speech. Being a CEO often means trying to never say anything to anybody that any other person could possibly construe as controversial. The idea is probably best expressed in a quote from long ago and quite possibly apocryphal, attributed to the basketball superstar and endorsement machine, Michael Jordan. There was a Democratic Senate candidate from Jordan's home state of North Carolina, Harvey Gantt, who wanted Jordan's support. Gantt is black, as is Jordan, and Gantt was running against an old-school white Republican incumbent, Jesse Helms, who was widely viewed as a racist. But Jordan declined to support Gantt. Here's what he reportedly said. Republicans buy sneakers, too. Michael Jordan was smart enough to know that even though he was still a basketball player, he was also the CEO of Michael Jordan, Inc. So, most CEOs are as anodyne as it gets, especially about politics. But when you're no longer speaking on behalf of your firm, you can say whatever you like. Take Jack Welch. Here's what he said in the fall of 2017 when I asked why he hadn't quit President Trump's Business Advisory Council, like many other CEOs did, after Trump spoke out in defense of a white nationalist protest in Charlottesville, Virginia.
I felt you're better off inside the tent, staying on the commission, seeing them, making your position known, than being outside. So I was one of the two or three that disagreed. But I wasn't an active CEO. I was the only retiree on there. So I didn't bang the table, but I thought it was a bad decision to express your frustration. But I understand if you got a lot of employees and they're rebelling over it, you might want to get out of town.
What's your assessment so far of President Trump's leadership style?
Well, I give him a D minus on management practices. And I give him an A-plus on policies.
You think you could run him through your management institute and get that D-minus up to a B or something?
Well, this is a guy that ran his own company. So he does things like, I didn't disagree with removing James Comey. I disagree with the way he did it. But he abandons soldiers in his army very quickly. Leaders of a corporation wouldn't do that.
So you think it's a function of him being in a family corporation where everybody around him is a little bit too obedient, perhaps?
Yeah, that's causing him problems.
Do you think someone of his age, experience, and position now, with everybody watching every move, do you think it's possible for someone like that to change as fundamentally as you're suggesting he change?
We'll see. I think he's changed. I think he's changed for the better in many ways, in some speeches he gives. But the consistency isn't there by any means. I mean, he gives a UN speech that was remarkably effective, first class, and by the weekend he was having a fight with the NFL. You didn't hear another day of the UN speech.
David Rubenstein of the Carlyle Group doesn't shoot from the hip like Welch. In fact, his career has been marked by a quiet sense of discretion and propriety. Here's what Jeff Sonnenfeld of Yale said when he learned that Rubenstein was stepping down as CEO of Carlyle, but was going to stay on as an executive chairman.
So it's a shame only that he's stepping down. If he was to be moving beyond Carlyle, you would have prayed that he could have been lured into any presidential administration. You could almost randomly look at any cabinet position, for example. Literally, whatever role it was, it wouldn't be better served with him there.
Rubenstein has been a Washington fixture for decades. He's recruited many former politicians to work at Carlyle. He himself got his start in the Carter White House.
So at 27, I was the deputy domestic policy advisor to the President of the United States, a job I obviously wasn't qualified for.
Now, I've read that you stayed late at your job to make sure that your memos were on top of the president's briefing pile.
It's, for better or worse, completely true.
And I've read that your net worth is a little north of $2.5 billion. Is that accurate, if you care to confirm or not?
You know, I've never calculated it. I see what Forbes says. It's more than I ever dreamed I would have. I have signed the giving pledge, and I'm committed to giving away not half of the money, as the giving pledge suggested people do, but to giving it all away. So whatever it is, I will give it away.
His giving is already well underway. In fact, you have to wonder if Washington itself might be crumbling, if not for David Rubenstein. He gave $18.5 million to restore the Lincoln Memorial, $7.5 million to repair the Washington Monument after earthquake damage, $75 million to the Kennedy Center, $2 million to the National Zoo to bring in some elephants. He also buys a lot of historical documents and has them put on public display.
I bought the Magna Carta and then other historic documents like the Emancipation Proclamation or rare copies of the Declaration of Independence or the 13th Amendment came to me, and so I would buy them. I bought the first book ever printed in the United States.
What was the first book ever printed in the United States?
It's called the Bay Psalms Book, printed in 1640. The first printing press was brought here in 1638. This was the first book printed. There are about seven copies. One was auctioned off a couple years ago, and I won it, and I paid the highest price ever paid for a book. I'm not sure I'm happy to brag about that. I think it's about to be put on display at the Smithsonian.
Why is this how Rubinstein chooses to spend his money and time?
I would say, in my case, I am giving back money to my country because I came from very modest circumstances. My parents didn't have any money. They didn't have any education. I rose up with a last name like Rubinstein to be able to do what I did. And I do feel that I owe this country because I don't think I could have done this in other countries. And so I'm giving it back in this way and to education and to medical research. My biggest concern is I'm now 68 years old, and actuarial tables being what they are, it's unlikely that I'll live another 68 years and maybe not even another 38 years. So I wish I had all the resources I have, the access, the willingness to do the kind of things I can do and the ability to do the kind of things I do when I was 37. I would give away all the money I have today, every penny, if I could be 5 years younger.
Mm, just 5 years, really. That's quite an arbitrage.
Life is so pleasurable. Even if you're not wealthy, you know, money doesn't necessarily make you happy. Some of the saddest people I know are the wealthiest people I know. And some of the poorest people I know are some of the happiest people I know. You know, Thomas Jefferson said, life is about the pursuit of happiness. But he didn't tell us how to actually get happiness. And it's the most elusive thing in life is personal happiness. Very few people achieve it. I think I'm personally happy, but, you know, I think I was happy before I was wealthy. So, you know, I don't know that the wealth has made me happier.
That concludes our look at the secret life of a CEO. Thanks to David Rubinstein and all the other CEOs who spoke with us, Steve Ballmer, Carol Bartz, Richard Branson, Ray Dalio, Satya Nadella, Indra Nooyi, Ellen Powell, Jack Welch, and Mark Zuckerberg. If you want to hear full interviews with them, check out the Freakonomics Radio podcast on your favorite podcast app, including NPR One, or go to freakonomics.com/CEOs. Coming up after the break...
Well, I think there are 10 ways that Chicago has affected everyone's life, certainly in America. The first one is architecture.
Besides sausage, crooked politics, and the Bears, what has Chicago given us? That's right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
When I say Chicago, you say...
Hot dog.
Jazz.
Deep dish.
Sausages.
The Bears.
Slaughterhouses.
Windy City.
Stinky cabbage.
White Sox.
Cubs.
Oh, Second City, of course.
Cold weather.
The L.
BLT pizza.
All right, I get it. Even though I've spent a fair amount of time in Chicago myself, and I like it for a lot of reasons, the fact is that we don't talk about Chicago the way we talk about New York or Los Angeles, or for that matter, Austin or Boston, even Vancouver. Now, why is that? And more important, why should we care? I'd like you to meet a friend of mine.
Hi, my name's Thomas Dija.
Tom Dija is from Chicago.
I was born there, grew up on the Northwest Side. We still have the house that my father was born in, you know, 1929. So, you know, I think we go pretty deep there, and I feel I do too.
And Tom's a writer, a good writer. Not long ago, he published a book, and he did what we writers do. He went to the local Barnes & Noble to give a reading.
I'm the author of a book called The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream, which really covers the years late 30s through the late 50s.
Now, most bookstore readings, as you may know, are not very exciting. So an author will get up behind this shaky podium and will nervously read a couple sections of his or her new book and then take a few questions, if anybody actually bothered to show up for the reading. And the writer's always hoping that someone will ask about the very deepest themes of the book, this book you've been slaving over for a few years. But usually, well, here are two questions that every writer gets asked at every reading. One, do you prefer writing on computer or longhand? And two, do you have particular times set aside every day to write, or do you write just when the muse strikes you? So most bookstore readings are, how shall I put this, low-impact events. But when Tom Dija did his bookstore reading for his new book about Chicago, it was nothing like that. It helped that it was packed, but what really made it work is that Dija didn't just stand there and read random passages. He basically delivered a sermon, a detailed and fascinating and, to me at least, very compelling testament as to how Chicago, as he puts it, built the American dream. Why America as we know it today would be unrecognizable without Chicago's many contributions. Now, there was just one problem with this amazing lecture, which is that I didn't have a tape deck with me. But Tom Dija did agree to sit down later in a proper radio studio to talk about how Chicago changed America beyond the hot dogs, the sausages, and even the BLT pizza.
Well, I think there are 10 ways that Chicago has affected everyone's life, certainly in America. The first one is architecture.
I was always impressed by skeletons of skyscrapers.
Mies van der Rohe in this period comes over to Chicago in 1938, chased out by the Nazis, and goes to the Illinois Institute of Technology and rebuilds their new campus there on the near south side. And while he's there, he really brings forward that steel and glass style of architecture. Very simple, very luxurious, but it's his image of what America can be. There's something powerful, very rational, very luxurious. And that becomes really the template for the face of big business, the face of big government, and the face of the American skyline.
So when we travel around today and I go to Charlotte, North Carolina, or Los Angeles, I'm seeing second, third, fourth generation Mies, yes?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Number two, what do you have?
Number two, I have music.
Now, when I was a young boy, at the age of five,
first place one lands on is the Chess Brothers, Leonard and Phil Chess, two brothers on the South Side who retake this kind of little hobby label called Aristocrat and turn it into the home of the blues. The first big player they have in there is Muddy Waters, who comes up from Mississippi in 1946, and he trades in his acoustic guitar for an electric guitar, and he really creates this new sound.
I'm a man.
Yeah!
I spell him H-I-N.
Muddy really kind of speaks, I think, for a lot of black Americans who come north. By the mid-50s, though, you have that first wave of rock and roll, the kind of jangly, you know, rockabilly kind of style of rock and roll. And the bluesmen are shunted a little bit to the side. They go from being really hot to not being able to get a gig. And so almost out of desperation, a number of them, led by Muddy Waters, go to England. And people line up to see them, people like Mick Jagger and Paul McCartney and Eric Clapton. And so the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, all of that British invasion rock comes directly from the impact of Muddy Waters and the other Chicago bluesmen.
The way I make love to a woman, you just can't resist.
I hear you.
So that is, I think, a deep musical tradition that comes out of Chicago just in these years.
Number three, please.
Number three is food. I mean, I think we all think of Chicago as being the, you know, the hog butcher of the world and packing houses and all that. By the mid-50s, all that is pretty much gone. But there's another guy out in Des Plaines who has a major impact that we all live with today. His name is Ray Kroc.
McDonald's is our kind of place. It's such a happy place.
American public are basically beef-eating people. And it wears well. And I can't give them everything they like, but this one thing I sure can.
He grew up in Chicago and is selling Mixmasters when he meets the McDonald brothers in San Bernardino, California. And they have this fabulous fast food restaurant, which is doing crazy business. And something about it, the whole system attracts Ray so much. He makes a deal to franchise it with them. And his dream, which I think he pulls through on, is he wants to offer kind of quirky entrepreneurs like him at a point when it's all about corporatism. Big companies, gray flannel suits, getting on the commuter train. He wants to offer people a way to have a small business, but that is still recognize the economies of scale, the things you get out of being in a big business. Ray was very much into quality. I mean, when you went to a fast food store or a restaurant at this point, you might get a hole in the middle of your hamburger. You might get something that was full of ground up, you know, offal, various organ meats instead of ground beef. It was a kind of, if there was a Wild West time in fast food business, this was it. And Ray said, no, we're going to give people good food. We're going to give them something to do out in suburbia. They can put the kids in the car and go do this. He was all about creativity, independence, and ironically enough, I think small is beautiful. So which is not something I think we think of as McDonald's now, who is kind of the great Satan to so many people around the world.
Number four, please.
Number four is kind of the University of Chicago, which produced so many great things. And you get everyone from Kurt Vonnegut.
I'm the only creature who has to figure out what to do next and why. Everybody else is a robot. I am pooped.
To, you know, Susan Sontag coming out of there.
Every event has a little label on it, which says, and to think that this, too, is within the realm of the possible.
Nuclear fission and the great books in the Encyclopedia Britannica, Saul Alinsky and Friedrich von Hayek.
The idea that the price system is really essential as a guide to enable people to fit into an order.
In, you know, the Chicago School of Economics, all these things are bubbling out of there, so it's incredibly influential in that way. But the thing that I think has had more impact that came out of University of Chicago at this point was a theater company that started by a guy named David Shepard, who left New York with a certain amount of money in his pocket, and he meets Paul Sills, and they start the Compass Theater down in Hyde Park. Part of what was in there were what they called scenarios. They would come up with a kind of dramatic arc, and then it was left to the performers to just make it up as they went. And
so it's improv.
It was all, yeah. It was improv.
Sills, 1, 2, 3, fight! Drive in there, Pam. Drive. Keep your head down, Pam. Look at the ball. Look at the ball, Pam. Pam, get in there. Drive. You can just... Oh, my God,
Pam.
What's the matter with you?
I hardly know him.
Oh, this very basic part, I think, of Chicago creativity. And in 55 with the Compass, I think it really does come to flower.
And does this all feed into the creation of Second City?
Yes,
then, eventually?
I think as a side note.
Name for us some of the alumni of Second City.
The old, you know, kind of the first round, the Alan Arkin, Alan Alda, Joan Rivers, I think the great... you know, the Saturday Night Live period, Bill Murray, John Belushi, Aykroyd, Gilda Radner. Today, it's people like Tina Fey and Stephen Carell and Stephen Colbert.
Number five on Dige's list is television itself. So TV took root in New York and L.A., but it found a different voice in Chicago. Producers there made smaller, more personal shows, shows to fit the American living room. The Today Show and The Tonight Show came out of Chicago. And later, of course, Oprah.
John Travolta!
Ricky Martin! Tyra Banks!
Let's get back to Thomas Dijah!
If a person can't be happy after that introduction, you can't be happy.
Number six on Dige's list is the modern civil rights movement.
'Twas down in Mississippi, not so long ago, when a young boy from Chicago stepped in a southern door.
Emmett Till grows up in the early 50s at 63rd and Cottage Grove in Woodlawn. His mom is from the South. The family's from there. So he sends one weekend in early August 1955. He goes to visit family in Mississippi, and he is lynched for allegedly whistling at a white woman in a grocery store. Up to this point, usually you would expect the body to be sent north, the mother to bury the body in shame. But Mamie Till does something which I think is remarkable and remarkably important. Instead, she, when the body's opened, she gets photographers there. There are people there from Jet, and she shows the photographs. They end up being in national magazines all over, and it's horrifying. And it becomes a catalyzing, very emotionally catalyzing moment for Black America. This really explained to everyone, no matter who you were, if you were Black, this is what white America thinks of you right now. Later that year, that December, is when Rosa Parks does not get up out of her seat on the bus in Montgomery. And she tells Mamie later on that all the time she was doing that, she was thinking of Emmett Till. So in many ways, Emmett Till lights the fuse of, I think, what we can call modern civil rights movement in America.
The color of his skin was black, and his name was Emmett Till.
Number 7 on Tom Dyge's list of 10 things that Chicago gave America: the Institute of Design, founded by Laszlo Moholy-Nagy. It was originally called the New Bauhaus, and it went on to produce a generation of hugely influential arts educators, photographers, and designers. A lot of our corporate American imagery, so the logos for NBC and Mobile and Chase, PBS, for instance, were all designed by one-time students of the Institute of Design. Number 8 on his list of 10 key Chicago contributions: urban preservation.
Yes, a man named Richard Nickel, photographer from the Institute of Design, who really finds meaning in his life by, he becomes obsessed with Louis Sullivan, the great architect in Chicago.
Who had died in, well, not in disrepute necessarily, but underappreciated by it.
Underappreciated, alcoholic, and really kind of swept under the rug a bit. What Nickel does is he does a project. As all these Sullivan buildings are coming down around Chicago as it's rebuilding, he takes photos of Sullivan's buildings. And in 1960, the Garrick Theater, also known as the Schiller Theater, is slated to come down and be turned into a parking lot. And what Nickel does is begin the first great, I would say, grassroots landmarking campaign. The building does eventually come down, it was torn down. But Nickel becomes the spokesman for the kind of preservation. And so, through his photography, later on, Nickel actually dies. You can say he's a martyr to the cause when the Louis Sullivan's great stock exchange building is being torn down. He's going in there every day to take photos and preserve what he can from what's in it. And a part of the building collapses and he dies. He disappears and is found months later, his body in there. So it is a very tragic story, but he has a great amount of importance, I think, for landmark preservation.
Number 9. Not literature per se, but a romance between two writers that paved the way for just how a stormy romance should play out.
I think the greatest writer Chicago produces during these years is Nelson Algren. And his love story during this time with Simone de Beauvoir, a woman who the New Yorker at the time called, quote, the prettiest existentialist.
Was it a long list?
I don't know. Camus was good looking. I don't know what the other options were there.
Algren wrote The Man with the Golden Arm. It's a great novel about a heroin addict named Frankie Machine. Frank Sinatra played him in the film. And Algren encouraged his one-time lover, Simone de Beauvoir, to write The Second Sex, which became one of the Bibles of the feminist movement.
Female emancipation is very much related to sexual emancipation. The two cannot be separated from one another, and it is our traditional attitude on sex that has placed woman very much in this second-class, non-human role in which chastity has been more important than human welfare.
Chicago, like a lot of great cities, has a way of producing opposites. So the modernist Mies van der Rohe and the preservationist Richard Nickel, the rigorous University of Chicago and the completely unbridled Compass Theater in Second City. So maybe we shouldn't be so surprised that a city that helped midwife the second sex also produced the man who was number 10 on Tom Dodge's list.
He grew up in my neighborhood, Hugh Hefner, who was a very withdrawn boy. He goes off, kind of finds himself in high school, becomes a big man on campus, goes off, serves in the war as a typist, comes back, University of Illinois, GI Bill, gets married, does all the right things. But it's 1952, and he is very unhappy. He is obsessed with sex, and his wife is simply not. And two, he had enormous dreams for himself. You know, he could look downtown and had always dreamt of swanky women and jazz music and mink stoles and all that kind of stuff. And he's not having it. He lives in a little apartment on the South Side in Hyde Park, actually. He works at a magazine job that he hates. And so he decides in 1952 to just throw it in. He's going to start this dream magazine that he's always wanted to do. And it's going to be a men's magazine for people like him who don't hunt and fish. It's going to be a guide to how to deal with this new consumer culture that has just exploded in America in the 50s. And it's going to have pictures of naked women, which is a wonderful thing, but they're going to be classy. And I think what makes Hef successful and Playboy successful is something that's very Chicago-based. New York is, I think it's fair to say, your value is based on what you can do that other people cannot. The doors that you can open or that open to you that don't open for other people. And in Chicago, there is that urge of a city that loves to host conventions, that loves to show people around. And it's about inviting everybody in. And Hef does that. He invites you in. He wants you to read the magazine and get, you know, you should be able to get a hi-fi. You should be able to get a cool bachelor pad. The Playboy clubs were about going, and if you paid your money every year, you could go to this place that was kind of like the mansion and hang out and be a part of that world. Yeah. And so it was a calculated and very smart business strategy, but it was about inclusion, not about making it so exclusive. Yeah. It was about come on in.
And that's really a metaphor in many ways for Chicago on many levels, yes?
Yeah. I mean, I think the city, I think it has a very people-oriented aesthetic that
comes out of that. As opposed to institutional, yes?
Institutional, yeah. I mean, you don't go to Chicago to get the awards. You don't go there to kind of join an academy. That's a kind of East Coast thing. You go there to work your ideas out.
But let's be realistic. Chicago is no longer that place where as many people are working out as many ideas.
The fact is, Chicago's peak population was in 1950, 3.5 or 3.6 million people. Today it's 2.7. You know, New York has not lost those people in that period. Other cities have gained those people. It is not going to ever be Detroit. It is not going to implode, I think, in any way. It is still a wonderful, healthy, thriving city, but it's not the city that it could have been.
And that, says Tom Dija, is a shame. Because America, at this moment, needs the kind of balance that Chicago has always provided.
What it came out of was the middle. And if there's anything we're missing now, it's the middle. You know, what is the middle of America? You know, people and other, we either sniff at it or we hold it up too high and think that it's the, you know, and Chicago had a kind of cynical, sensible understanding of what regular was. You know, you're going to mind your own business. You're going to, you know, have your house and your kids and sort of take care of yourself. You're not going to bug other people and they're not going to bug you, and you're kind of get on with it. And that idea of a place in the middle where we all meet and we look at each other and we try to figure things out. Chicago had that. I mean, those political conventions were just meant for Chicago, where everyone came and exchanged. It's where new people came, like Mies and Mahalia from wherever, other countries, other states, and brought new ideas, and without feeling that they had to immediately win, you know? And I think that coastal mindset leaves the middle without, and we need more middle in America.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thank you for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe. Talk to you next week. Waiting for the